Hello everyone, and a warm welcome to you. My name is David Riley, and I've been asked to keep Phil in order, which is a high challenge. And I've also asked to introduce him. How many of you do not know Phil Hanlon? That's what I thought, maybe one hand, yes. He is a man who doesn't need much introduction, but let's be honest. As you know, he has great difficulty talking in public. You know, he's quite inhibited and shy, so they've asked me to warm you up and busk along for a few minutes just to get going. And those of you who know Phil know, before I say it, of his striking qualities, of his integrity, and of his vision, and of his courage. Philip is an exceptional man who has been willing to try and find his path and speak it. And so the journey he's going to describe to us, like all journeys, I know, will have started before the apparent beginning of that journey. And I have an opportunity to know a little of that, because Phil and I were in the same year at Glasgow University and graduated in 1978, and we were residents together. And that was a remarkable time, and Phil showed himself to be a dedicated and conscientious doctor that cared about the patients and cared passionately about bringing his skills and intelligence and good-heartedness to that work. And he and I had a really wonderful time together. But I think at a surface level, Phil would say of that period himself, he's reflected to me, he wasn't yet aware maybe of the deeper journey that had to unfold for him, that I have a feeling we'll hear a bit more about today. And he then would go, I think, to the Gambia, Phil, and that in a way I suspect would be a reconnection to something, being the son of a missionary. Would that be a reasonable description? And I've no doubt that there was a beginning of an exploring and an attempted synthesis of the different paths and influences on his life over that era. We met up, though, probably after, 25 years of apparent silence between us. And from the call, I think it was something like you phoned me to say you had been reading some stuff around the idea of the shadow in a human being. And you thought that I was crazy enough to maybe have been interested in that sort of thing. And could he come and talk with me? And we sat together, a patient allowed us to sit together. And after it was a man that was describing a healing reaction. And that would be the area that my own journey has principally been involved with. And after it, Phil said to me this question that really touched my world. He said, how can we take what we have just seen in this single man and scale it to the level of a nation? Now there's a question for you. And that should let you know something of this man and of his depth and of his willingness to ask. And that then allowed us a wee bit of connection. I've been privileged enough to share some of the passage. And, you know, one of the many things, if we go on the website, there'll be a lot of many lists of Phil's great achievements and things that he'll have marked off. And one around that time was to head up the Public Health Institute for Scotland. And we had a wee shot to work together that allowed me to be part of a team that developed something called the Fifth Wave as an idea. And all of it would be about journey, actually. All of it would be about change. All of it would be about wondering, does it have to be this way? And could it be moved on an outer level, just as people aim in that journey of movement on the inner level and release for themselves? And in more recent times, Phil has been heading up, among many other important contributions, a project that might be nicknamed the Cultural Influences on Wellbeing. And has been working with, and I've again been privileged to be part of that, of trying to wonder about this inner journey, which in the end is all that we experience as human beings, and the outer journey, the community, the society, and the culture and world that we live in. How might they inform one another and touch one another? And all the while, I suppose, connecting to that, I'm sure, some of that reason that took him into medicine, which would be healing and a concern for humanity and rehumanization. And Phil's given us the talk title, as you can see, The True, the Good and the Beautiful. And there'll be something about the clarity of that, which again speaks of Phil and Phil's process. And I know you're going to be as privileged as I will be to share that with them. And maybe a last reflection is that Gandhi quote, become the change you want to see. And I think what we've seen in you, Phil, is your genuine journey towards the true, the good and the beautiful, including within your own being and in your work. And I want to thank you for that, and thank you for giving me and the rest of us the opportunity to share a wee bit of this important journey. Thank you, everyone. Phil Hammond.
David, thank you for those very kind words. And it has been a pleasure and a privilege to share some of all of that with you. And indeed, those of you who have heard me speak before will know that some of the anecdotes are indeed about David's work. So we seem to have something reciprocal going on there. The title is The True, the Good and the Beautiful. This comes from Plato. And Plato's basic argument is that we as human beings, all of us sitting here, naturally, out of our humanity, integrate the true or the scientific with the good, the ethical, and the beautiful, which is something to do with the aesthetic or artistic. Now, I'm going to basically argue that the modern world has to a degree lost us some of that integration. That the modern world has allowed the true in scientism, in economism, in efficiency, in targets, to eclipse and sometimes completely shadow the aesthetic. Let me illustrate that. Yesterday I was at the Tandy Scientifique and I met a really nice chap. He was an astrophysicist and he works at the university. And I said, what do you do? He says, you know, he says, the one thing we have to do is find the Higgs boson. Yeah? And he got really animated and enthusiastic about it. And as he talked, he said, you know, I've got PhD students and postdocs, and, you know, I've got to keep enough money going to keep them, they're now my friends and they're part of the collaboration and so on. Yeah? And he says, you know, there's just something beautiful about the way the world is put together. And to have the privilege of researching that, understanding, is a terrific thing. Now, an hour or so before arriving at the Cathay Scientific, I had been having a chat with one of my colleagues. Now, I know that in this room, many of you will work for the public sector in one form or another. And I'm about to describe a university manifestation of the phenomenon, but I'm prepared to bet in hospitals, in practices, in schools, and elsewhere, you will have met the parallel. And the parallel is something like this. Glasgow University needs to save, I think it's something like £30 million in the next 5 years, and there's a plan. And the plan has been communicated to every member of staff, who incidentally has been offered early retirement a voluntary redundancy if they'd like it. And each researcher has been given a target for research income, and that's led it to go up. And we've also been given indications of the targets for the number of top postgraduate students, master students. And some of my master students are here, and they know all about this, so I'm not embarrassing them. But you know, if you're international master students, you're worth even more money to the university. So we need to have 80% more. Not because it's a wonderful thing to meet colleagues from Africa and share and learn from each other, but because it earns us 9,000 quid per shot. And all I know is that people who labour under external targets for research income and the desire to get more postgraduate students and the desire for some narrow idea of efficiency, and in any case, if you'd like to leave, we'll just stop paying you goodbye. They're heads for them. Not all, but many of them. And what's happened is that some narrow idea of true has eclipsed their sense of the good and the beautiful. And I contrast it with the astrophysicist who spoke of his intrinsic motivation. Nobody was making him take his people in mind. And he could hardly work any harder just because he loved it. Because he exemplified the integration of the good, the true and the beautiful. So that's kind of where we're going. But my subterfuge is to share with you something of my sabbatical leave last year. I figured that I only get one sabbatical leave in my professional lifetime, and I gave my term, and I put that together with my summer holidays, and I get quite a long length of time, and I felt truly privileged. My wife Leslie took unpaid leave, and we planned what we're going to do. Now, those of you who know universities, the thing to do with the sabbatical, it seems, that I was determined not to do, was to find a university somewhere in the world who would give you a desk and an office so that you could go and do much the same as you do in Glasgow, but do it there. I didn't think that was a very exciting option. So what I determined to do was to undertake three journeys. One was to explore the past consciousness of humans, one was to explore the modern consciousness of humans, and one was to meditate or to inspire as to the future consciousness. It sounds very grand when you say it like that, I know. But that was kind of the idea. And the other thing was, because I had experienced it before, I wanted to see whether cycling, with its exercise, its repetitive action, its closeness to nature, and walking, could be a productive way of doing work. Yeah. So the idea was that we would cycle and walk, and we would have our diaries at the end of the day, and we'd use that as a form of reflection and learning. That was the idea. And I want to point you to this picture up here. This picture is in the mountains of Leon. And we're about 3 weeks into our journey to Santiago de Compostela. I'll tell you a bit more about that later. We had crossed from northern France the valleys of Seine, the Loire, the Dordogne, the Lot, the Garonne, over the Pyrenees, then to Pamplona where the Bulls run, through the Rioja region, and you then get to that vast Spanish northern plain, at one end of which on the route is the ancient city of Burgos, at the other end is Leon. It takes 3 days to cycle across it with vast horizon. We had left Leon that morning, and we were now in the mountains of Leon. At morning coffee time, we met a young woman from France who was walking on her own. And one of the things she said was, you know, you really feel safe. Other pilgrims look after you. Local people look after you. Everywhere you go, local people would shout, Juan Camino. You feel safe. Then, as we climbed, we saw two other cyclists. Mostly they were walkers, but there were some cyclists. And this turned out to be a couple from Chile, from Santiago de Chile, who were determined to come and do the pilgrim route to Santiago. And his bike gear mechanism was malfunctioning, and he had no tools. As I was, someone had done this before, I was able to get out my handy multi tool set, and 10 minutes or so later, he was on his way. But there was a lovely sense of discussion, connection, sense of shared journey, and he just, for half an hour, just sat there, shared a bit of his life and what it was like in Chile. And we cycled on there, and we're quite high, and we're about to descend through what seemed like the biggest rock garden in the world, with broom and wildflowers, and a beautiful perfume in the air. And as I'll mention later on, there's this sense of connection. You know, a bridge I'll show you later, which pilgrims, one or two at least, every day for the past 1,000 years, and you're in continuity with these people. Your fellow travellers, of whom I'll say a little bit more. But the one thing I want to share with you is that at the end of that day, Leslie and I were commenting that, you know, when you're cycling, you can't help but on a warm day run over the odd worm or bug or. That actually became a problem for me. And you were zigzagging to try and avoid the bugs. That your sense of connection, even to those tiny creatures, seemed very, very real. And it felt different to be alive from a frazzled day on a Friday afternoon after meetings and teaching and all the rest. And that is part of what I want to share with you. This idea that
There is something about modernity and all its pressures that robs us of that. And yet all of us have got that sense of connection, that sense of empathy, actually quite close under the surface. And one of the delights of the journey was to allow some of that to re-emerge.
So, that's what it is. Three journeys, and I'll
dip into it. I'm not necessarily doing those orders, because there's
other things to say and to talk about. This is Canada. It's Lake Lorraine. And I want to say two things about Canada, first of all, by way of introduction. The first is that we spent some time at a place called Regent's College, and we were speaking to philosophers, historians, economists, theologians, and others. And one of the striking things was that when we said a word or two about the interest that we had on the sabbatical leave, we were living into past, modern, and future consciousness, as a matter of fact, they basically come to each other and say, well, modernity is in crisis and collapse. It's going to come to an end quite soon, isn't it? Now, that doesn't happen to be around lunch tables in Scotland, don't know about you, but there was amongst that grouping at least a ready acceptance that modernity is in decline, and that we were living through that, and that we, the urgent task of the day is to build something new. And I thought that, wow, gosh, that's interesting. But, see these lovely pine forests? And this is Lake Moraine, because that grey area is moraine over glaciers. So that's actually glaciers coming down the mountainside covered by moraine. The forests
are currently, and this is only in the last 4 to 5 years, being decimated. I mean decimated. 1 in 4 trees dying. Perhaps the whole forest will go because of the pine beetle. And the pine beetle usually is killed by extreme winter temperatures. It takes about 10 days, apparently, at minus 30 to kill the pine beetle. And there's enough of that type of temperature normally to keep a balance. So there's always some pine beetle death, but there's never been a problem. But in the last 5 years, the winters have not been severe enough. And people talk to us of their genuine fear that that massive North American forest area could literally, within a decade or two, be completely destroyed. That
and the fact that the glaciers
are in retreat. You know this big controversy about the IPCC and whether they falsified the data on the glaciers? You know, when you stand there and somebody told you the glacier was here 10 years ago and it's now here again, you don't need an IPCC report. The evidences of that ecological crisis are there and palpable. That, together with this sense, modernity is a crisis and will soon be coming to an end, gave us a very different perspective in that part of our journey. And it will be interesting, I'd like, when we come to discussion, that people reflect as much as ask questions as to whether we think that's a good perspective that Canadians have, and whether we should share in more of it, and what it might lead to.
Our main purpose in being there, though, was to explore something called the Burgess Shale. Now, to understand the Burgess Shale, you have to be aware of something called the Cambrian Explosion. And the Cambrian Explosion happened about 530 million years ago. Up until then, there had been very simple forms of life. There were multicellular forms of life, but they were relatively simple.
Then suddenly in geological terms, that's to say over the course of many millions of years, but nonetheless in geological terms, suddenly we have this explosion of life in enormous diversity. And on a cathedral escarpment, as it's called, in an ocean bed, 530 million years ago, creatures like this, a whole ecology of them, with herbivores and carnivores and hunters and all the rest of them, emerged. And only in two places in the world did a certain form of fossilization happen. One in China and, well, now China, and one in Canada. And that fossilization was of a nature that even the soft parts of these creatures were preserved. Normally it's only the harder parts of creatures that are preserved. So what is there in the Burgess Shale, and it's actually up just underneath that big mound of rock there, is a quarry discovered by a man called Walcott. Walcott was the head of the Smithsonian. The Smithsonian Institute. Then I got out, and he was looking for fossils in these mountains. The story goes he had his family with him. He actually, in his diary, talks about how oppressive he found New York and how it was an enormous break and retreat to be able to go up into these mountains. And the story goes that it was his last day, and his wife was coming back down on horseback. And the horse kicked over a rock, and there was this perfectly formed fossil. And they quarried and found probably the most significant fossil find ever made. So you can now go and visit it, and it is a UNICEF site, and you've got to book ahead, and they take you up with a guide. Oh, by the way, I don't know if you can see it there, but is it sharp enough? Can you see the dead trees in amongst those at the front? That's global warming happening. The other thing to say about that is, if the forests die, they release enormous amounts of carbon, which is a positive feedback loop for further global warming. So, we climb the hill. The guy at the front is our guide. He's an astrophysics graduate and knows a lot about all sorts of stuff, and it's very interesting. The guy behind him is an evolutionary biologist from North Carolina, and others were similarly qualified. So it was high-octane conversation as we climbed. But the thing that I remember as we climbed was he was trying to give us a sense of the time scale. And the first thing he said was that tectonic plates move about the same rate that your fingernails grow. So what we're about to see in the quarry moved from the seabed up to something like 9,000 feet up the Rockies at the rate that your fingernails grow. So it was a long time ago. That gave you one sense. But he was then trying to give us a sense of how old the Earth is and where these events fit in. And they used a metaphor that Carl Sagan first used in his television programs, where basically, if the Big Bang was New Year's Day one year and the whole history of the universe is a calendar year, where do things fit in? And what you see there is that lots of the things happen that we are kind of way, way back through till November. That all the events of our awareness are actually into December. But the guide said to us, he said, remember, he said, the dinosaurs came for Christmas. And that's why I went and looked this up. The idea that something which to our perspective is as old as the dinosaurs, in this perspective, is Christmas Eve. And if you look down the bottom there, apes appear at 10:15 a.m. in Hogmanay, and 1 second before midnight, Christopher Columbus sets off for America. Now, question: what does that do for our consciousness? I'll, in a second, explore the medieval consciousness and how it was very aware of a religious worldview. One of the reasons I was so keen to go there is I think evolution is one of the awarenesses that has changed human beings' sense of who they are. And what this can lead us to is the notion that we are a speck somewhere, insignificant. Or, it can lead us to say, wow, think of that, and here we are. And what's more, we are the first time in all of this time that sentient, conscious life has appeared. Daniel Dennett says, it's as if the universe grew a nervous system and we are it. This is in Yoho National Park. Yoho is the Cree word for all. And I would just gently suggest that an awareness of this timescale and our place in it, rather than give us a sense of purposelessness, should engender a sense of awe. At least for me, as we climbed and talked and considered, that's
certainly the case. This is us actually in the quarry. Bits of rock with stuff like that just lies about. The best samples have been taken away to various museums, but there's still masses to see. And we collected some together and put them in boxes and various things. It was a remarkable experience. But what I want to share with you is another thing that happened to me. You'll be familiar with a diagram like this. Oh. Do we really want to do this?
I don't like
it. No. Will you look after that for me?
Yes, I will.
Thank you so much for that. There's the web of life, or the tree of life, as it's often put forward. This guy Walcott, whose wife serendipitously found the rocks, and
thank you, that's kind of you.
He had this vision in his mind. In other words, what I'm getting at here is that models and mindsets determine what you see. And when he picked up these fossils, what he did was, and as I showed you, that's why I showed you that artist's impression of them, they're scary, strange-looking creatures. But basically what he did was he fitted them into what he understood to be the tree of life. Now, the hero of this story is an Englishman from Cambridge called Whittingham. And Whittingham came along, and as a public health person, and my students will know this, I'm a fan of holistic approaches. Occasionally they talk of reductionism and sit on the floor immediately so that it's clear what we think about this. But Whittingham was a reductionist scientist of painstaking patience. And what he did is he basically, when the fossils formed, even though the soft parts are preserved, the weight of the rock crushes the things. So if you could take Andrew as an example, imagine Andrew being fossilized into something this thick. We quite have to know what Andrew really looked like if we didn't know. So what Whittingham did over the years was he got a dentist drill and took layer after layer of rock and reconstructed what the creatures looked like. This is one of his drawings. Isn't that amazing? And it gave me a respect for, a fresh appreciation of the value of painstaking, patient research. Because sometimes when you do these, you know, the truly beautiful stuff, you can give the impression that that's not the point I put across you. Much of what we understand is because of that form of patient, painstaking, reductionist research, and it gave us a crucial insight, and it was this.
But there is not one tree of life.
But in the time of the Cambrian explosion, there were at least five. And only one of them lived. And that's another truth. Of all the species that have ever existed, well over 90% of them are extinct. So, to be here is good. And to stay here is better. But it should warn us of the risks in this universe. And basically,
these creatures fit into some of these other ways of life and have no modern counterparts. That's what Whittingham showed. And basically were experiments in life that nature posed them.
And what we see is not just the survivors of one single tree of life, but of the particular trees of life that have gone. Stephen Jay Gould, who writes elegantly about these things, also argues that there was no particular predictability about it,
and if we rewound the clock and played the game again, we might have ended up, and we might end up with a very different set of organisms. That's a controversial view, I know, because two of the evolution biologists on the trip had a big fight about it with each other. So I want to fast forward to the Dordogne.
Different trip, but you don't mind, because you went there, it doesn't matter what order we did it.
But this is the Lascaux Caves, which we visited. And the point here is that in that sweep of the world's history, of the universe's history,
We're now well into December, but actually looking back way before any recorded history. We don't know why people painted these beautiful, massive paintings. To stand and look at them, you wonder if it was their sense of awe at these animals, their sense of respect for them. Some people even think it was how you initiated youngsters into the hunt, and you got them used to these scary creatures by giving them a sense of them in the darkness. No one really knows. But the point is that their dawing, for all it was beautifully sunny when we were there, was at that stage on the edge of the ice, because it was just at the point that the ice age was receding. And it was one of the few places human beings very sparsely populating Europe were, and they stayed in caves. And my point is that it is the favourable climate and circumstances of what's not much more than 20,000 years in which everything we now have and see this beautiful, elegant room has emerged. Very short time. And we build upon the achievements, insights, contributions, and civilizations of those who have gone before us. And we do find ourselves at a time when the whole forest system is under threat and much else. So I don't think it is an exaggeration when those colleagues in Vancouver speak of crisis. And they know of what they speak. We met Bruce Alexander, who writes, and some of you will have heard speak. And his interest is in drugs and addiction. He used to be a drug worker, psychologist and a researcher. And he walked into his professor, he told him about it, he said, I can't do anymore. He says, it's hopeless. Yeah? You can only spend so long doing something that doesn't work. So he went away to be a historian. Yeah, complete change of career, but he's kind of like that, I think. And as a historian, what he discovered was that, because he was interested in drugs, different times in history, drugs surge up, other times are not there. It's true of the Roman Empire, it's true of Europe, it's true of different parts of Europe. And so he began to look into under what circumstances people turn to addiction. And he calls addiction overwhelming involvement. Yeah, that's what he means by addiction. If you become overwhelmingly involved, and actually he expands it, he says you can do it with work, you can do it with pleasure, you can do it with alcohol. And he says, what's more, it is an adaptation. It's better than that person's next best alternative. And he did a lot of work amongst the North American First Nations people, who used to range across these beautiful hills and were eventually put in reservations. And their whole web of meaning, of relationship, of purpose, was ripped away from them. And they turned to overwhelming involvement in alcohol and drugs as part of their response to all of that, even though some exciting things are happening in the way of change. And when I showed him the data for Glasgow, very soberingly, he said, that's the key. This is these people being through something incredible. And his other analysis is that the other main grouping in Vancouver who experience overwhelming involvement with drugs are the rootless young professional classes who on average move job every 2 to 3 years, coming to Vancouver for a period of time. It's constantly voted one of the best places in the world to live. But they too have a sense of alienation, rootlessness that causes them to come to overwhelming. So that was another one of the things we learned almost through a serendipitous connection. And here we have a people who express themselves with these beautiful paintings. And they begin a process of 20,000 years of human history, only the last several thousand of which we have a written record of. And in part of that written record is the story of pilgrimage. Now, actually, when we were en route to do the cycle, we went to the Eden Project first, and we called into Bath. And at Bath, as you know, there's the Roman baths, where water comes, geothermal springs, comes out of the ground, gallons and gallons of it every day at 46 degrees. It's very warm. And in Roman times, indeed before Roman times, it was a site of pilgrimage. And the Romans built a temple to Minerva, and people came as pilgrims. So because of that, they were just pilgrims. And in the museum are little lead pieces where people would scribble their request to the goddess before they threw it into the water, in case the verbal message got mixed up, I suppose. And there was a whole list of what they were. And mostly, they were requests for justice. That's intrigued by this, you know. So-and-so has done me wrong, would the goddess please put it right? But it's basically the same refrain over and over again. And it struck me that what people do is that when they feel their own power and agency is at a limit, they turn to their version of the gods for something to take them beyond that. And so it was, I think, with pilgrimage. Santiago is in, as you can see, the northwest of Spain, way over there. It's not a great map, but you've got the picture there. And people would come from all over Europe. We actually started in one of the starting off points in Chartres in northern France, but there are various routes. The first route was from Le Puy, where the Bishop of Le Puy made the first pilgrimage. And the point is this, that I wondered why they did it. I'm going to say a bit more about why they did it in a second or two, but the main draw was the fact that the relics of the saints were there. They really did. I wondered if they did. They really did believe in the power of relics. And where those roots came together, they came together in this bridge. I'm going to say a word or two about the bridge in a moment. Let's think about relics for a moment. So the idea was that St. James's bones were there in Santiago. And the story they had to account for this was that he came during his life, he had some fairly unsuccessful preaching escapades, went back to Jerusalem where he died, and on his death was drawn back to Spain on a boat made of stone pulled by angels. Now, that is such a ridiculous story to our modern ears. I had to ask myself, did anyone ever really believe it? Was it just a metaphor? And as much as I could find out, they really believed this stuff. Literally so. But one result of that literal belief is things like this. Now, this is taken from the concrete monstrosity over which the lawyers go, which will be lucky to be there in 1,000 days, never mind 1,000 years from now. And I asked myself, what was it inspired into its six stands? See these wee kind of door-like, you didn't have to put them in, that's to make it look like, to look beautiful, wasn't it? And it was made by communal labour over three generations. No one had a big bag of gold that could make that rebuilt. It could only be built if everyone just got together to do it. So what I'm getting at here is already you see that it was a different spirit, worldview, consciousness, call it what you like, in that era. And if you move into the religious buildings, some of that becomes clearer. And the point is this, that if you were a medieval pilgrim, you literally did believe that the earth was flat and came to an end. In fact, you can cycle on as we did to finish there on the coast where the horizon is, and they literally believed that you fell off the earth at that point. Now, lots of them went on to do it. You bump your boots on the coast. I don't know why they did that, but lots of buckets. They literally believed that the canopy above was the veil of heaven, and that there was fire below them in a literal place called hell. They literally believed that God would judge them at the end of their lives, and that their actions here dictated that fate. Now, I know that there are many people alive today who still share that belief, and I'm not trying to disparage it, but I do think that very, very few people today believe it in the way that the accounts of medieval pilgrims seem to have been so. The point I'm making about that is that if the human consciousness has changed so much in that length of time. It is arrogant of us to imagine that the human consciousness will not change again. So when one speaks of a world which is stable, peaceful, where empathy rather than competition informs our relationship, why is that so impossible? Now, I'm not arguing that human nature changes. I think the people who drew those pictures in Lascaux Caves, or who built that bridge in Puerto de Arena, who inhabit Vancouver today, and those who will be in the future, are still intrinsically human in important ways. But consciousness can and obviously does change. And we should take inspiration from that and ask ourselves, what are the things that will inspire a change in consciousness, a growth in empathy, an awareness of connection, a desire to build a better future? Well, one of the things is to take a jump into the purpose.
I realise it's an enormous privilege to have had the time that we enjoyed, but it seems to me that
there is a real learning and pleasure and companionship and connection to be had through this. When you get to the bottom of the Pyrenees on the French side, you get your shell to go on the pilgrimage, and you fill in a wee form, it's all run by volunteers, and this wee thing is, why are you going on the pilgrimage? And I think there are five categories. It's something like religious, recreational, sporting, I don't know, whatever, you know. And there were probably lots of people who ticked them all. And that was true even in the Middle Ages. In fact, there were lots of clerics who railed against the pilgrims who did the pilgrimage for a bad reason. Now, what's a bad reason? Yeah? Some of them did so just because, you know, it would be the one really adventurous thing to do in their lives. Some of them were looking for a spouse. And why not? I think that is going on today, you know? The biggest demographic was people in early retirement, but they were all ages. Let me give you a sense of some of the people we met. That place is a Basque village, and we ran across a Scotsman in a kilt who was a London lawyer who had lost his job. And he loved meeting people. He spoke French and Spanish like that, and he was unashamedly walking the Camino to have great conversations. And he heard there was a really interesting Basque innkeeper at this place, so he was going to go and stay the night and check in. We met a man from Switzerland, deeply religiously Catholic. Thought there were far too many softies doing the that's for cycling, that I mean. But he was absolutely imbued by a Catholic tradition and all that meant. More commonly, people were doing it out of some kind of inner journey that didn't have any religious, sometimes a spiritual, but not always. A teacher from Canada, in his 40s I would guess, loved teaching but had had enough of it. Decided he wanted to do something else with his life. When you walk, you do it in stages, and there's a definite stopping point. So he knew he was 5 days walking away. He says, I'll finish it because it's going to be finished. But my work here is done, I know what I'm going to do next. So he had set a new course in his life. A gastroenterologist from Cologne in Germany, an older man, I guess, about 70, sparkling eyes, he had said to me, he said, you know, the communal called me. And he knew that I was kind of, because you meet these people and you don't know who they are, and I could tell he was being a bit critical. He said, no, I had a dream about it. And he says, I didn't know anything about it, and here it was, I was dreaming. He says, God did not cause me to dream. I must have known something about it. But I took it as a call. And here he was, meeting people, bringing new pleasure to them, in a lovely and playful manner. 250,000 people travelled last year to Santiago. When we arrived, 600-700 people crammed in to the midday mass. And we sat beside a group of Spanish children. I think most of them had learning difficulties. And the two teachers had walked 50 kilometers with them. And in this day of political correctness and wondering what to do, at the point of the service when you have to greet people right about you, the teachers went and hugged each one of them, congratulating them on their achievement. As I say, some had walked for days, others much shorter periods, as we queued up to get our certificate of completion. There were three Irish women in front of us who had walked 50 kilometres, the last 50 kilometres. And in a thick Irish accent, they said, "You know, we never dreamed we could do it." And their sense of accomplishment in their older age was just as great as those who had travelled much farther and longer and endured more arduous journeys. This is the Eden Project. We thought it would speak of the future. And in a sense it does. It's about plants and humans' relationships with plants. It's an inspiring place in many ways. You can see its scale. Many of you will have visited. So I don't want to put it down. But you know, when you arrived, the only way you could get there was by car. And there were about 30 car parks, all different layers, and you were getting a ticket so you didn't get lost and you wanted to find your way back to them. And at every point, there was Eden Project stuff being merchandised, sold. It was a consumer experience in that whole context. So it left me with the sense that we are at best edging our way to the future, and even some of the more visionary projects are still very much trapped within the confines of our consumerist world. And there are colleagues here from the IFF, and they speak of transformational change, and I think it's a good phrase. And one of the things I think we need to do is to find examples of transformation change. Who are doing that? I don't think that they will be integrating the good, the true, and the beautiful. I think that's now our most urgent task. Public health, my own profession, needs not to be solving trivial problems like obesity, and I know obesity is an enormous problem, but engaging with others and many others in wondering how we inhabit this future, how we bring about a change as profound as that saw the medieval world morph into our modern world. I have more to say about the good, the true, and the beautiful, but I suspect I've said enough for just now, and it would be nice to hear from yourselves. And if it's right, I'll throw in some of that. And if not, I hope I've adequately shared some of the insights and learning from these three remarkable guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Phil. I'm wondering, Phil, what box did you tick on the form? And what do you think really called you to it? You know, at one very critical, important level, you've spoken of the understanding of the past and future and present consciousness. But I'm wondering, within your own consciousness, what was calling you? And did what you found, did it differ from the box you ticked?
I think the most meaningful thing was those type of heightened experiences that I tried to capture a little of at that top of the pass on the mountain, and that sense of connection with nature and with other people taking the journey. But there were other dimensions of it. You said I was the son of a missionary. I was brought up in a non-conformist Christian background. And there is a magical worldview in that as well. I mean, we don't believe in saints and relics, but there is stuff like that. And there are three things you do when you get to Santiago. That you go to the Mass, which I spoke of, you get your certificate of completion, and by tradition you go and you hug the statue of a saint. Yeah? And I did. Yeah, so here I'm hugging the statue of a saint. And I just thought, how ridiculous, you know? And it was quite cathartic. I felt released from emotionally from the magical worldview dimensions about my own past. Mm. I think intellectually I'd been released from them a long time, but there was something about that journey and just being there. So in a sense, there are things that we all of us have backgrounds and baggage, there were things to be left behind. And so the journey in part helped me leave some of that behind, as well as feel the power of that sense of connection and empathy, which I think is central to what we all need to move towards.
And maybe just a final question for myself. The journey clearly hasn't stopped for you.
No.
And maybe one of the most interesting, I suspect most difficult parts may have been not living in the future consciousness, as you were saying, but the returning to now. I wonder if you could say something of the transition back into now, back into the university that you spoke of at the beginning and so on. What did the journey do for that process?
Well, one of the things one recognises, if you go to this little Good, the True and Beautiful, back in the medieval time, people who built that bridge, you know, those cathedrals, had a sense of the Good, the True and the Beautiful. They were informed by that. But it was an undifferentiated view. So when science came along in the form of Galileo and said, you know, the sun doesn't go around the earth goes around the sun, then we don't have a geocentric universe. He was put in prison, not because they thought what he was saying wasn't true. They did actually think it wasn't true, but that wasn't their main problem. What they recognized was that their sense of symmetry and what was beautiful, as well as their sense of what's moral, the authority of the Bible was being threatened. They couldn't separate these spheres to examine them separately. And we've lived in the good of all of that. So the university is a place where you can do all of that. But what we've done, as I tried to suggest in my opening anecdote, was we've allowed considerations of the true, not in a kind of beautiful way of trying to find truth, but in the sense that there are only certain forms of knowledge and certain forms of motivation, particularly economic efficiency, targets and all of that, and it eclipses all others. Such that people find, and this is what's so extraordinary, was the people one met during these journeys were open. They might not have started that way, but there was something about the journey that made them open. Whereas back here, there's a closeness. And I found myself doing it. I'm busy, stuff to do, need to get on, chase these efficiencies, these targets, these external motivations. So that's been tough, although there's also stuff you can draw on, I think, as we all know, a little bit to go with that.
Thank you, Phil. Let's throw it open. Who'd like to kick off with a question?
Make comments or observations or your own anecdotes as much as questions.
Okay, there's someone here, thanks. There's a roving mic, if you could hang on. And would you be kind enough just to give us your name and maybe a one-line background?
My name's Harry Hunter. I'm working as a director of the government. And I'm doing master's at the moment, which is taking me into lots of stuff about complexity and uncertainty and ambiguity. There's a lot of vendors with that for me. The bit that I kind of flip about is how much you can really deliberately influence the transformation of consciousness. If we haven't deliberately got to where we've got to, if there are lots of different paths we could have taken, how on earth do we know whether we can deliberately go in a certain direction?
And that's a very good question. My sense is that what we can do is, in a mechanistic way, control these things. Those who are part of the MPH know that I have this riff where we talk about understand, predict, control. And that's been amongst the big success stories of public health. We understand that polluted water causes diarrheal disease. We can control it with fresh water and with sewers. We understand that inoculation with cowpox protects against smallpox and so on and so forth. But many of the problems we face today don't fall into that category. Even problems like obesity, they are in that realm of complexity. They arise out of the complex system of food production, retail distribution, the marketization, commodification of food and all the rest of it. And there's going to be no drug or policy which in itself is going to be transformational with respect to those things. And that's why I'm saying that what we need is a community of people restore some of that balance. If I'm right, that part of our problem, I just say only part of our problem, is that we've privileged certain forms of being above all others such that they are eclipsed. If we, in our own lives, in our own departmental lives, in our own family lives, in our own city life, restore more of that balance, then we're not doing understanding and control, we're creating a different climate. And I think that's going to make it worse.
Thank you. Someone here.
I'm Jerry Patney from Health Scotland. We're going to do a presentation talk. Can you think of examples, perhaps now or in history, where either a country or a community or a culture has been dominated by one of the other parts of the diagram, which is so perhaps dominated by the beautiful or dominated by morals? Or other examples, as I'm now in history, of communities or cultures that have managed to integrate the three elements you've built out?
Gosh, that's a good question, Jenny. I think if we look for other forms of imbalance, I think theocracies are such. Yeah. So Thomas, what was his name? Aikenhead? 19-year-old youth, Edinburgh University, hung by the neck until dead for blasphemy. And that was in 16-something or another. Andrew knows the story better than I. Sorry? 1696. Not that long ago. That was a world dominated by a warped form of morality, I would say. And we've got examples of that today, don't we? So I think that exists. What some analysts say, though, is that actually what's being defended is not just morality, but their undifferentiated sense of what's true, good and beautiful. So they can't see one without the other. And I think that is probably what's going on. And what the Enlightenment did was allowed us to let these three spheres flower in their own way. And, you know, we have many, many blessings from all of that. So maybe the idea of integrating them consciously while still being able to use them separately is the challenge of our generation rather than something we can look to in other times.
I think you were just first there, yeah.
Hello, I'm Jackie Sands, the Arts Coordinator for NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde. My question, I suppose, is if you're looking to create connection and empathy, where are we going to be looking? Where are these agents for change and these people who are going to be involved in consciousness change?
Well, I don't mean to be trying to answer because it's a serious and important question, but the man who's just taken the microphone from you is one, David Bradley is another, and I don't know everyone in this room, but there are many of them in this room. The Five Diet Project is such. I met a woman called Pat Abel the other day there, who's recently retired and is involved in the most extraordinary kaleidoscopic network of transition town, guerrilla gardening type activity. I meet these people everywhere. I don't think it's a self-conscious movement at all. It's merely that as human beings, we're seeking to edge towards a better way. My instincts are that in the world of the arts, there are many more. Let me brief anecdote from Canada in this respect. Those of you who know me know that I'm mixed best with people once I know them. I'm not one of these enormously gregarious type people. And we had been, I've been writing for much of the day, we've gone for a walk, and we've come back, we are the only little cafe bar in town in this new place we were staying. And there were four people waiting for a train. This was something like the Orient Express, which only came through the Rockies every 6 months, and they were there as train spotters from Calgary. And we got chatting to them and whatever, and they said, "Are you coming to the Calgary Stampede?" Now, you can see the Calgary Stampede didn't immediately fit into the aims of our And we said, "No." They said, "You can't be here and not come to the Calgary Stampede. You must come to our house this weekend."
Now, we're Scottish lunacy, you know, and we find ourselves saying, yeah, that would be lovely. And we knew nothing of them, and indeed, the guy who's renting us the house said, if you're not back by Tuesday, I'll inform the police. But we went down, and on the Friday night, he was a retired policeman, and she turned out to be an artist. And she had invited several of her pupils around. And it was, in many respects, the most extraordinary evening of the whole semester. As these people spoke of creativity that they believed every human being possess, what blocked creativity, and how we could use what they were doing in their art classes and others and in schools to allow that creativity to flourish. And it's so dovetailed with our entire inquiry. And when we spoke of what we were doing, they could add so much insight. So I think it's important, but I don't think it is yet a self-conscious movement.
Thank you. There was someone, the other gentleman there, yeah.
Thank you. I'm kind of struggling with it though, because I think what you say kind of implies an idyllic past where all is well, right? And I'm not sure if at this point in our history, you know, we've never had it so good in terms of life expectancy, etc. So I'm kind of thinking, where is the crisis? I've met Bruce Alexander and often think, you know, if the Cree had the trauma and that led to their alcoholism, was their primitive life so good? And what is the trauma in Glasgow? Is it post-industrial? But we drank more in the industrial era. Was it becoming a city? Is it urbanisation? I think we have to be careful in harking back perhaps to some balance that was once there in human history. It's not so simple.
A helpful corrective, and based on that, I have no sense in which there is a golden era to hark back to, and there's nothing to go back to. I also agree with your general observation that all eras have their problems, challenges, and almost every generation has believed that the world is coming to an end. So what makes ours more likely to be so than anybody else's? So I take all of that entirely. And there was nothing very good about life expectancy of 34 and all the rest of it. And indeed, when we go through the achievements of understanding, predict, control, all of us are the beneficiaries of it. So if I fail to communicate that, then let me just agree with you in that connection. I think, though, that there are two things that I would say we have a problem with. One is that our world is not sustainable. Now that means that it won't be sustained. That's what the word means. It doesn't mean we'll carry on with it exactly as we do if only we get enough tides and ale and, you know, windmills going. It means that our very civilization doesn't have the resources to sustain it. So that's one part. I think that was part of what the Canadians were speaking of. But the other is what on the website we call the dis-ease of modernity. The fact that we do have an epidemic of obesity, of loss of well-being, of addictive behaviour. And you're right that when the Industrial Revolution came, levels of alcohol harm were much greater than they are today. But that was the same phenomenon that Adam suggested, was people being ripped out of their way of meaning and significance and put into another circumstance. And all I'm really probing at is, are we in a similar circumstance?
Thank you.
Hi, so David Conway, a public health lecturer in the Dentist School of Obstetrics. Thanks very much for having me. I think how you described the start as a courageous career, a courageous life, and that's certainly a courageous journey you set out for us there in your presentation. I was also struck very much almost by the last comment you made about having the courage to go beyond the remit of public health to the narrow remit in some ways. How can we collectively foster that courage when some of our colleagues do try and speak out and are knocked down by politicians saying get back to going beyond your public health remit? So how can we collectively move into three spaces you described.
I think I would want to draw a distinction between narrow public health professionals. If I can flick on to... It's gone, forget it, doesn't matter. There's always going to be a role for people who can do what David and Bruce can do in terms of analysis and all that kind of stuff. There's always going to be people but if you go back to the first wave of modern public health, you know, back when Glasgow was a city with a life expectancy of 34 and there didn't have any sewers or whatever, there were no public health professionals, none. The public health movement was informed by civic leaders, by early Nessian scientists, by community leaders, all sorts of people banded together to make the beginnings of modernity happened, and with that eventually, and it took 20, 30 years before they started seeing any real improvement in life expectancy. So I would suggest that whatever we do to happen next, we need people, whether they be artists or architects or housewives or kids or whatever, who get this and in some way embody it and want to do something about it. And they will be the force of transformation. Now, I'm not saying that's public health, but I think the next wave of health change and improvement will come from that. And public health professionals who get a living from doing it might find a different way in it. And the thing I was going to try and put up here was this wee model here, which suggests that we actually need a lot more to do this well. So we'll need all the conventional science, all this stuff that these guys are struggling with to get the MPH. The syllabus won't get any smaller. Yeah? But in addition to that, we'll need ecological and systems and complexity sciences, and we need to be a lot more aware of all of that. We'll need conventional ethics, you know, do no harm, do good, respect autonomy, build justice. But we'll also need ecological ethics. Yeah, if we are currently using 3.2 planets to maintain our way of living, how do we create an ethical framework that would deal with that? We need conventional aesthetics, stuff that blinds the heart. That guy who was the astrophysicist looking for his boson, you know, he's inspired by that. He sees beauty in it. But we also need to be challenged to raise our sense of consciousness. So that then becomes the syllabus for the new MPH. Might take 2 years, I'm afraid. You take my point. So I think public health will need to get into and actually embody much more about that.
Okay. Andrew?
My name is Heather. I'm in an organisation that helps other organisations to collaborate and people to get fresh insights on the factors and inspire change. And I'd kind of like to just offer a reflection and maybe kind of seek a bit of a conspiracy with you, in that we have recently come to believe that where we can make the biggest impact is really to help teachers to fundamentally rethink the kind of role and relationship that they have with young people. And in particular, we've started to talk in quite a simplistic way, but I think quite a sort of complex model about the difference between knowing and not knowing, and the fact that so much of our society and community nowadays really mostly values knowing, and so many of our rewards and recognition systems are around knowing, but in fact not knowing is also so important to all of this. And we had a lovely experience recently where we were working with a primary school, and we sort of went down with our, you know, fancy not knowing views and methodology, and kind of day one of the project's utter chaos. And we were really expecting to get a kind of strip torn off us by the teachers, who could therefore show that our thinking was totally impractical and didn't work. And in fact, what they actually did was say, what you've helped us understand is that we are part of the problem. We are actually the reason why these young people don't know how to behave and how to control themselves and how to manage their own behaviours, and we need to learn from you. And we were so struck by their humility, and I think that it kind of chimes with what you were saying earlier, that I think people are out there all over the place who want this change to happen today. And I think that education in its broadest and widest sense is absolutely fundamental to this, and it's about changing the behaviours inside education. That's why I see Queen's Bliss with you, because I think you're in there and you can do some of this.
One thing. Thank you. I think you just agree. Thank you.
Hi, from Sarah Patterson, Kales Life. You sound more like an evolutionary than a public health person, because I think public health as a profession has lost some of its kind of evolutionary zeal. A few years ago, there was a review of public health in Scotland, and people dared to ask who was the advocacy role that had really been at the forefront of what public health was about, whereas many people have been kind of straitjacketed into systems and organisations. And it struck me that when you were talking, the forms of media through the histories and civilisations, whether it was very controlled or hieroglyphics, or whether it was papyrus or people who stood in the street and read the news, I wonder how we could take this revolution, which I think many people in this room and beyond, the colleagues here from Slovenia who are having their own quiet revolution and how they do stuff in Eastern Slovenia, how we could use the media in such a way, you know yourself how people will represent what they say, how we could take that advocacy role and perhaps help more of the people in the communities and be a manager head teacher, I'll be here for what I say here. But seriously, I do think when you talk to Galileo and his ideas, in a way what you and other colleagues talk about in your lectures and the public is a revolution. Maybe we need more of a French approach to revolution than a Scottish business, British approach to it. And I wonder if there are ways in which we can try and do a bit more of that. How can we support you from within institutions to do that?
And who's on the names in your black book for Come the Glorious Day?
I'm struggling with that question myself. You know, at the public health conference, I talked about this with respect to the health service. And the kind of 22nd version of it, I said, was we'll still need evidence-based medicine, but we'll need to understand that the health care system is part of it. Is a system that is part of a societal system, and the trend line of increasing expenditure can't continue indefinitely, yet there will be other systems, pressures on it, that we are doing harm to people and not building their autonomy. But equally so, we're spending a resource greater than our share of the world's resource to keep this edifice going. What's more, with some other low exceptions, it's not beautiful. You know? Patients don't come in and find their spirits raised. And staff don't come in and see their consciousness raised. Wouldn't it be lovely if we could somehow work together to create a health service that maybe does less, but does it more ethically, more beautifully, more effectively, more consciously? I was asked for some examples of that. I said, well, for example, we use more than half of our bed days giving acute interventions to people who are in terminal physiological decline. I was interviewed by a reporter, and actually, although people said I was misreported in the Herald, she did use my words mostly. The editorial then talked about assisted suicide, and the Sun and the Record talked about a doctor who wanted to stop treating old people. So, based on that experience, I think we've got to be cautious about a full-on assault on this. I really do. I mean, it's made me think, actually, you know, if you enter the media and the media fray, it will be reduced, whether you want it or not, to these kind of sloganizing headlines. And I think our politicians understand this better than many, that, you know, whatever they say, it will be reduced to a soundbite, so they'll just say the soundbite. And that is part of our problem. So that's part of my response. The other part of my response is, actually, the desire to use the press and to influence, to communicate, and to make things happen is all part of that modernist mindset. And maybe we need to find a different way of making that change happen. I mean, I'm struck by, as well as concerned by, everything that's going on in the Middle East at the moment. And for 30 years, people will have got together in the rooms and said, this is a terrible thing, we're bad at it. We need to plan for change and whatever, and they never got anywhere. Then suddenly, literally, some poor man commits suicide by burning himself. And he sparks something which, you know, has been building, I guess, for 30 years. I don't know where that will end, but maybe that's closer to what's going on. So I don't have an answer to that. I think that's very much a work in progress.
Hello. My name is Ava
Campbell.
I'm from Glasgow's Fund of Biologists at Health and Dental Scotland, but I happen to be also enrolled in your MBA. My question is kind of twofold. One, do you think that the current economic crisis might be a great opportunity to actually move this idea onwards, not only to people like us who work in the public sector, but also to people who we would normally not collaborate with so much, like economists, businessmen? And I'm also asking because if you listen to some interviews on Radio 4, for instance, last week, I had an interview with Ray Porter, who is actually the big kind of business guru at Harvard Medical School, and he was saying, we're seeing an end of business as we know it, and we're actually undermining our own business because, you know, climate change, and because we're undermining our own local economies because we've outsourced everything to India or other countries. And I was thinking, well, it may be optimistic if you look at it from a cynical point of view, but perhaps there are people like him who now actually believe in this idea. And wouldn't this be the opportunity for us as public health people, if you look at the holistic sense, to kind of collaborate with, well, with people on that side of the spectrum?
Yeah, I would agree. I think these are difficult times to look ahead. On the economic crisis, the figure that really, really struck me when I read it was that it took from the Declaration of Independence in the United States until 1984 for the American banks to lend $1 billion in circulation. Okay? Because money is created by lending it into existence. And basically, there was broad stability on that time, leaving aside the Great Depression, because the amount of money in circulation more or less corresponded to the number of farms and bridges and buildings and businesses and schools and all the rest. In other words, there was a broad equivalence to the value of money and the value of stuff that they had created through the loans to make that stuff. In the three months before Lehman Brothers collapsed, American banks lent $1 billion into existence. Did the American economy create an equal value to the entire 220-year history from independence until 1984? It seems implausible, doesn't it? Yes. You know? Therefore, that's not good money. It means that there's much, much more money circulating in the system than there is real value. It means I'm not as rich as I really think I am. No, it's true. You know, I think they're going to give you this index and pension, and it's all going to be funded by that kind of stuff. So, to call it an opportunity is scary, actually. I think there's going to be a lot of pain and difficult things happen as a result of it. But what would be even more foolish would be to create another $1.5 billion so that there's enough interest to pay that back. And that's what we're currently trying to do. And that's even scary.
I think that's a question at the back.
Yeah. Annie White from Social Health Sciences Unit. I was wondering whether with the three dimensions of life that you're focusing on, whether it's possible for the true to work out useful measures of the good and the useful. And a lot of what you say is pointing towards alternative measures of well-being itself, which many movements have espoused. I'm wondering whether you think that's particularly useful, whether you think that for the scientists to presume that they could ever do that kind of measuring is missing the point, and it's actually would give them privilege over the other sections.
Yeah, it's a good question, and I'm not really thought about it. I'm not anti-measurement.
you know, spend a fair bit of my life trying to do bits and pieces of it. And if there's a better set of measures that would capture more of that, would help inform us and so on, I'm all for that. The difficulty, as you're hinting though, with measurement, is it draws it into that world and takes away from the kind of, you know, how do we know it's a beautiful scene, yeah? Well, it's purporting, it could then get silly. And I think that some of the well-being stuff seems to the public silly in that kind of measurement. So I'm rather drawn towards the way people measure live their life. You know, there's stuff they very much would want to measure and wouldn't take decisions on without absolute and appropriate measures. But there's other stuff that they would experience and share rather than try and measure.
Thank you. I think there was another question there.
Sorry, I'm Helen Mulber from the University of Glasgow Library. I just wanted to say that I was very struck by what you said about the contrast between your office life and your sabbatical, and again the return to the office. And also I'm very aware of what your public health colleagues have said about the constraints of perhaps trying to do things differently or have a different perspective in their own professional lives. And I wondered if you have anything to say about how that analogy might transfer to the way universities are working at home. Because it seems to me that it's very difficult to see how somebody with your vision and your abilities can function in a business model that's measured by economic success and REF output and all the rest of it. And I just wonder if you've any perspective on universities and where they might, what their role might be in effecting change in society.
I mean, for English universities currently to be seriously making plans to close down arts and humanities simply to make the groups plans, it's just philistines, isn't it? You know? And that's just one example of it. My own personal tactic is, I think, very similar to what most of the group will be. Yeah? So I meet the target for grant income, yeah? I get my papers for the REF, and I try and spend as little of my life ticking those boxes so that there's some time and space left over. But I do experience that some people get drawn into it and feel dispirited by that, and also that they get more and more frazzled as they try and meet more and more of these expectations. What's weird, you see, is that I don't actually meet anybody who lives their life like that. What's strange to me is that they can come along and be a principal of the university and live, you know, I mean, they wouldn't run their own lives, their own home, their own families like that. But it can seem unchallengeable in an institutional context. It would be nice to think that just as the Enlightenment brought with it new institutions that allowed people to live in that new consciousness, so whatever is to come next will have its own set of institutions and plausibility structures to support that. We're a wee bit away from that yet.
I think on that note, it's probably time to start wrapping up for us. And Phil, thank you so much for a remarkable talk. You were asking how could someone like Phil flourish in such an environment. You know, that, the lotus flower is sacred, isn't it? Because it emerges from dung. And there's something about the human spirit, Phil, which you're modelling for us, that somehow, despite all these constraints and pressures and history, you're managing to try and stay alive in some way and reconnect to life. And the change we're looking for, I suppose, will be inspiration, as inspiring one another. You know, the change, the revolution you spoke of, I think, is one person at a time, actually. And it's a personal revolution to somehow stay connected to the joy, stay connected to the journey and the life. And thank you for the inspiration that you bring for that, and for realising that as an agent of change, it's not about force. You don't use force, you don't push us around, you don't push us down. Somehow you open up space for us and encourage us, and that's invaluable. Thank you. Okay.